I'd like to now to hand it over to our moderator, Whitney Evans. Whitney is a KUER reporter. She's been with us for about 5 years. She's covered homelessness, poverty, local government, and education for the station. So I'd like to introduce to you KUER's Whitney Evans.
Can you hear me? Wonderful. I want to thank every single one of you for being here tonight. There are a lot of other events happening this evening, and I don't mind stealing a little bit of Jason Chaffetz's thunder, so I'm really happy that you're here tonight. This is such an important issue, and I know you all care so much about it, and there are a lot of issues that need to be clarified and that need to be talked about openly. We're here because Salt Lake City County and state officials have taken unprecedented steps to fundamentally change the way homeless services are provided in this state. And whether you find those decisions exciting or confusing or ill-considered, this process is moving forward. And we're wrapping up the third week of the legislative session, and there's state funding on the line for housing and services. Now more than ever, communication and understanding is key. I hope you all can agree with that. I'd like to think that we can all leave here tonight feeling like we've learned something and that you were heard and your opinions were heard. I realize that a lot of you, like Terry said, may be concerned about a particular location chosen for the new shelter resource centers. I want to talk about that. That needs to be talked about. But I'm hoping we'll be able to have a larger conversation about this overarching model as a whole. So I want to thank our panelists for being here today. Thank you all so much. We have Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams. We have Tara Rollins, Executive Director of Utah Housing Coalition. And we have Jackie Biskupski, Mayor Jackie Biskupski. Kathy Bray, President and CEO of Volunteers of America. So thank you all so much for being here. Let's give them a hand. In just a moment, I'm going to give them a couple of minutes to just talk a little bit about themselves and what part they play in this discussion. But I want to take a moment first to get to know the audience that is here tonight. By clapping your hands, because we can only hear you, not see you, I want to know how many of you have been homeless or are close to someone who has been homeless. By clapping your hands, let's just say. That's quite a few of you. How many people are here to simply learn, about the issues? How many of you are here to speak about one of the particular locations specifically? All right. So now let's talk a little bit about these panelists. Mayor Ben McAdams, can you talk a little bit about what your part is in this entire process?
Sure. Thank you, Whitney. So homeless services in Salt Lake County, when we first started with this process a couple of years ago, you know, the question was raised that we've got to fix the challenges that are facing us with homelessness. And at the time I said, you know, what does fix mean? And, you know, before that somebody came to me and they asked me to sign a pledge to end homelessness. And I said, well, I'm happy to sign it, but what does end mean? You know, knowing that the homeless have always been among us, and you're always going to have somebody who loses a job or loses a home. So what does end mean? What does fix mean? And the response that I got was, just sign the pledge. Don't worry about it. And I said, no, I think if I'm going to sign a pledge means something. I want to know what fix or end means. And so what does a functioning homeless services system look like? What does a fixed challenges mean? And we didn't really have good answers for that. So we started at the time and said, you know, what we wanted to do was map the genome of homeless services in the Salt Lake Valley. And so we started saying, to understand the genome of homeless services in Salt Lake Valley, we need to understand the money that goes into homeless services. So we mapped every dollar that flows into it from various different sources. And one of the things we know today is that in the Salt Lake Valley, we spend about $52 million per year on homeless services. And that includes a whole hybrid of sources. The largest funder of homeless services is Salt Lake County at about $20 to $22 million per year of homeless services. Next to Salt Lake County is the state of Utah with a roughly a similar amount. And then you've got private sources, philanthropy, faith-based resources, individuals and businesses who step up to fund homeless services. So that comprises the bulk of homeless services funding. And then our next question was to say, well, let's map not only how the funding flows through the system, but how individuals flow through the system so we can understand that better. And through that process, we were able to diagnose, I think, a few flaws in the system right now. By and large, we have a system that was designed to meet people in crisis and to alleviate their suffering by providing shelter and a meal. And what we saw is that it was hard to measure what the exits from homelessness looked like, what a successful exit looked like. We were trying to find things that were going well that we could amplify. And, you know, I don't mean that as a criticism, because we have incredible homeless service providers that are on the front line serving people in crisis, and I'm grateful for the service they provide. But we wanted to find where the exit paths were and how we could open up and support those exit paths, successful exit paths, to people who exit on the path to stability and greater self-reliance. And what we found was there were some gaps, that there was a lot of relapsing into homelessness. The people who left often returned. And we wanted to make homelessness rare, not recurring, and short, the duration of homelessness short. And so we saw some gaps there where we saw a lot of people who were homeless for periods of time up to a year, well, chronically homeless that are homeless for more than a year. We've done a lot of great work to reduce chronic homelessness through the permanent supportive housing program facilities like we see with Palmer Court. But we saw a lot of people who were persistently homeless for a period of time less than a year, but from 3 months to a year. And so we saw a lot of areas where we thought we could reduce homelessness and address some of the challenges by making homelessness shorter in duration. So looking at people who are in shelter and helping them to get out of shelter as quickly as possible. One of the things that we've concluded is that shelter is not an ideal place to help someone to heal from homeless services. So one of our goals is to divert people from shelter wherever possible and to minimize the stay in shelter and maximize successful exits from shelter. So we, through this process, we brought together our Salt Lake County Collective Impact Committee to say we wanted to look at every dollar that Salt Lake County spends and also other public and private dollars that come into homelessness and try to align it towards the outcome. So we brought together over 30 homeless services providers, and we've been meeting monthly for the last couple of years. We have about 75 to 100 people who come to those meetings. And what we did, first of all, is we identified some outcomes. What does addressing the challenges look like? What does a better functioning homeless services system look like? And we worked through this and adopted 14 outcomes of homeless services system. And it's those outcomes that we adopted that have been guiding our work since then, to say, as we look to what we currently spend or any new investment coming into the system, to make sure that every dollar we spend aligns with those outcomes in a data-driven fashion, that we're using empirical data and social science and evidence underlying those expenditures to make sure that every dollar we spend is advancing us toward our goal of minimizing homelessness, of diverting people from shelter wherever possible, minimizing the impact of homeless services on the surrounding community, minimizing criminal elements among the homeless, and various other outcomes. So that process brought us to a point where we said, okay, now we understand the genome of this system, and we're ready to start acting to change the system in a way that will be better for our communities, but also better for those individuals in crisis.
So, Mayor McAdams, can I just point out, clarify a little bit,
yes,
that your focus is on improving the service model.
That's
You're not focused on the selection of the shelter,
right,
resource centers. You're focused on the model and,
right,
improving
that model.
Right,
so while homeless services are largely funded by Salt Lake County and the state of Utah, services are located in cities. So Salt Lake City being one of the largest hosts of homeless services, but other cities, Midvale City hosts facilities, West Jordan hosts facilities, Sandy hosts facilities, but Salt Lake City being one of the largest. So what we said was we're going to allow the cities to take the lead on the physical aspects of homelessness, location and that, and the county is going to take the lead on the services. Now, we also recognize that there's not really a bright line between between that. So where facilities, what the service is, and how our ability to effectively deliver a service in some sense is affected by the location of the services. And similarly, the location of the services, the appropriateness of a location of the services is influenced by the quality or type of services that's being provided in a location. So we've kind of roughly said cities are gonna lead out on the geography, the geographic location of services. The county's going to lead out on the nature of the services, but recognizing that there's an interplay between the two, and so we're going to work collaboratively and respectfully with each other to really identify consensus so we can move forward in a collaborative model.
Let's move on to Tara, and can we keep these introductions as brief as possible because I want to get to audience questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm Tara. My name is Tara, and I've been in the affordable housing community for going on 22 years. I started off with Assist in Salt Lake City, where they do emergency home repairs for low-income people. And going into people's homes and seeing the multiple generations living there and understanding that people cannot afford to live out in the community was heartbreaking. The Assist really was a program to maintain people in their homes so they weren't becoming homeless because their houses were deteriorating. They stayed on the tax roll. It is a great program. But then I got more involved in the Utah Housing Coalition, which had no staff. It was all volunteer. It's been around for 40 years. It was a place where advocates got together and talked about how are we going to house people. Who have the lowest income. And so I became the first executive director 12 years ago. And so I have been working mostly solo, but we have achieved a lot. We have an educational conference every year, and we're a membership organization that goes from anywhere from a provider all the way up to an investor. So as you can see, we run the gamut there. So we have a lot of people at the table that are very knowledgeable about housing.
So Salt Lake City has the largest service provider in the state for homeless services, and that's the Road Home. And when I came into office a year ago, one of the things that I was working on immediately was set up prior to my coming into office, and that was working with a committee that former Mayor Becker had established on site selection. And that committee continued to move forward and do the work that they were intended to do. And then the session started immediately, and I worked very closely with Mayor McAdams to make sure that the state became a critical partner in this, because the homeless services that are provided in Salt Lake City are provided for people from all over the state. And we wanted to make sure that the state played a key role and participated in a way that would help Salt Lake City not be the community that really had to provide the majority of services for the entire state. So we locked arms and secured a very strong partnership with the state and have been moving forward in a very collaborative manner regarding the funding for these new resource centers that will be built, as well as funding for services. And that partnership is still strong today. And, in fact, I think the state is now even stepping up even maybe further to make sure that we are able to provide services around the state in a much more effective manner than what has been. So moving forward, working with the committee and the city council, Salt Lake City had selected four sites with a maximum capacity of 150. We originally started with two sites at 250, and the council was very uncomfortable with a facility of that size. And so we came to the conclusion and agreed to with the state and the county to these four sites with a maximum capacity of 150. That capacity will be capped through a zoning ordinance that will be passed and worked on by the council. So I think that covers that.
Great. Kathy Bray.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bray, president and CEO for Volunteers of America Utah, and I'm glad that I was invited to participate tonight. I really appreciate it. I think it's important to have a service provider voice, and that's why I think I'm here to just provide that perspective. Volunteers of America has been providing a bridge to self-reliance and health for individuals who are experiencing homelessness, behavioral health issues, both substance addiction and mental health, for 30 years in Salt Lake County. I think I'm here to share information with you about operating our Youth Resource Center. We do have a resource center that we opened about 9 months ago and are learning quite a bit. It's smaller than the other resource centers that we're talking about, but we have 30 in shelter and see 60 to 70 a day in our facility. I think we've learned some things that we could share about the service model and some best practices that we're utilizing and we'll share with whoever ends up providing the services at the new facilities. Also, we've been operating the Detox Center, which is a residential unit, for 30 years. So we have some contributions to make and are happy to be part of the conversation.
All right. Thank you all. I want to start with one question, and then I'll open it up to the audience. Mayor Boskupski, can you talk a little bit about what a resource center is and how it's different from the shelter that we have currently?
Well, I think what Mayor McAdams was conveying is that really a shelter was created to give people space that would protect them from the elements in our environment and provide food. And a resource center is really driven by assessment and assistance. So really getting to the core of trying to understand what's brought you to our front door to begin with. And is this the right place for you? And trying to make sure that as people are seeking assistance, that in the continuum of care, where do they really need to be? And is this the right door for you? And if it isn't, let's let our assessment drive where you go from here. And it's very different than just having a roof over your head and some food.
Okay. Mayor McAdams, did you want to add anything to
that?
Yeah,
no, I think that, one of the things we're trying to do with this is to make sure that every investment, every action we take is data-driven and empirically established. And so the same would be for the resource center. So some of the things we've talked about is not only system-wide, what's happening in our system-wide, but we're looking at even an individual footprint. So resource centers, I think, and again, I'm not criticizing any provider because our providers have stepped up to the plate to stellarly perform what we've asked them to perform. And candidly, we're moving the goalpost on them right now. We're saying, you have a great system for alleviating crisis. By the way, we're changing the rules of engagement. And so a resource center is we want people, yes, we want you to provide a meal and a bed for people, but we want you to connect, and they do this already, but we want to connect people to services aggressively so to make sure that they're getting the help that they need, the treatment they need, the substance use treatment, another treatment, connection to workforce services, helping to find housing and a job. With the goal being, I guess I often say that right now, let me analogize it to the healthcare system. You can go to a clinic, you can go to a doctor's office, you can go to an emergency room. And oftentimes I think, our emergency room is a place of emergency. Ideally, you never go to an emergency room. And when you do go to an emergency room, you're there for hours. You're not there for days. You're there until you can get into a better facility, a more sophisticated facility, or if you can see something coming, you go to a clinic instead of an emergency room. Well, I'm afraid that our homeless services system right now has become, it's the emergency room that's become the primary place of care. And so we have people that are going to our emergency shelters, and they're there for months or years, and they're not getting the type of help they need. They're getting the most expensive type of services that isn't really connecting them to a long-term exit path. So a resource center would say, we're going to treat these like an emergency room. People come here for a short period of time until we can get them placed in housing or an inpatient treatment bed or into a job or, whether it's through housing vouchers or other mechanisms. So we can see these more as a temporary stop rather than a primary place of healing.
If you have questions, you can go ahead and come to the microphone if you're ready to speak. Is Michelle Flynn in the audience? She's with the Road Home. I can't see.
Yes, there she is. Straight ahead.
Hello. I really would like to get...
Do you want me to speak a little bit more to the model?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. While people are lining up and getting ready, just a couple more pieces on specifics of the resource center model. What I would share is, as a provider, you have things like a daily routine, where ours is like open the door at 8:30, so those who didn't stay overnight and want to come in for breakfast, come in for breakfast. It's all client-centered, that we look at each individual and what their history and what their needs are, what their strengths are, and how we can help them. We have a lot of services right on site that we can link them to, including all of the ones that Mayor McAdams mentioned. We also have like a legal clinic. We're talking about bringing mobile medical. We have a couple therapists on site, because every individual has a different set of circumstances, and we want to work with them to integrate them back into the community as soon as possible. We're using best practices like motivational interviewing and also trauma-informed care because of the traumatic histories so many of the youth have faced. So I just want you to know that we do have some best practice interventions that are all lined up and within our center for our transition-aged youth. These are 15 to 22-year-olds, is our focus population, so there's more on education and more on employment as well. So I can see the line. So thank you.
I know Tara had one more thing to say, and then I promise I'll get to the audience. If we can make it really quick.
I will.
Why come to me? It's always
I'm
quick.
Sorry, every time it comes to you.
That's okay. I just want to put out the challenge. And one of the things that is so important to understand is the lack of housing that we have in our communities. And so right now in the state, we are lacking 38,447 units. And that is for 30% of AMI. And people always ask, what's that? That's 20,610 a year. That's $10 an hour. So we have a lot of people in our state that make $10 an hour, and they're paying more than 50% of their income to housing. It's really important to put that into perspective as we're looking at these resource centers, and we need to expand the right inventory for our for all Utahns in the state.
Let's start over here with George. Hi, George.
Hi. Mayor McAdams, the hundreds of drug dealers downtown, what will it take for the county to lock up those drug dealers long-term so all the money that we're spending on drug addiction treatment isn't wasted when they get out and encouraged to stay addicted?
Well, thank you, George. So I think George is highlighting one of the key concerns that we've seen with it. And a lot of people ask me, what has changed over the last 2 years to leave us in such a fundamentally different place? I think we all feel that things are different in the last couple of years. Well, let me tell you what's happened recently. The legislature 2 years ago, two legislative sessions ago, adopted some criminal justice reforms that are called the Justice Reinvestment Initiative. The Justice Reinvestment Initiative was motivated on the premise that what we're doing right now is we're taking people who are mentally ill, suffering from a substance use disorder, we're taking those people, arresting them for possession of drugs and incarcerating them in the state prison. And then they'll go there and they'll be warehoused for sometimes years in the state prison. Well, through a collaboration with the Pew Charitable Trusts, the state of Utah did some analysis and they said, this is incredibly expensive for us to warehouse people for several years. And they calculated what they were spending. And it really is pretty sad when you look at the data shows, while not intentionally, the effect of what's happening is we are incarcerating mental illness at much higher rates than we're incarcerating people who are not mentally ill. So the premise of justice reinvestment was to say we're going to take that money we're spending on incarcerating, we're going to change the laws, so felony offenses that are leading people to prison, we're going to change those drug possession offenses, and instead of making them felonies, we're going to make them misdemeanors. By making it a misdemeanor, it means someone will spend, instead of spending years in prison, they're going to spend weeks in jail for the same crime that was previously for the possession of drugs. So that was good. I supported the Justice Reinvestment Initiative. It was great to see collaboration at the state level supporting the Justice Reinvestment Initiative. But then what happened with the implementation of Justice Reinvestment, the companion piece to Justice Reinvestment was we're going to pass this legislation changing criminal penalties, but we're also going to pass a form of Medicaid expansion. So whether it's Obamacare or Governor Herbert's Healthy Utah Plan, we're going to pass some form of Medicaid expansion so these people who are sick, who are mentally ill, who need a treatment for drug addiction so they can have treatment. Well, as you know, if you followed the debate, what happened is the Medicaid expansion got hung up. Governor Herbert came forward with his plan, Healthy Utah. It passed the Utah State Senate, and then it got hung up in the House of Representatives and didn't pass. So you had the penalties change, people no longer be incarcerated in the state prison. So they were sent to the streets with no treatment plan. And so, you know, I've called this not justice reinvestment, but justice de-investment. We took the money that we were spending on incarceration and just spent it elsewhere in the state and not invested in a treatment. So what we've seen now is you've seen people on the street who are addicted to drugs. You've seen drug dealing grow because there are more customers out on the streets. It's about 7,000 people who we calculate who were would have been in state corrections previously and are now on the streets. So that is the challenge, and that's a lot of what we're seeing right now is what's really swamped the system. And so we're working with the state legislature to say, look, we need help. There was a promise that we were going to provide treatment for these people. The promise was not delivered upon. And I want to give credit to our state legislature. They're hearing us. They're working with us, and we're working right now to identify funding to get those people into treatment. If they're not willing to accept treatment, we're looking for funding to get those people incarcerated again, because what we don't want, I'm not a believer in warehousing people who need help, but we also don't want to make our communities unsafe. So we're looking at this additional funding for treatment beds, additional funding for incarceration for people who are committing crimes on our streets. And so I think there's a path forward there. That's what we're working at, but that's what I'd say is a lot of what you see on the streets right now is that state-level policy change that has you're seeing expressed on the streets of Salt Lake City.
My name's Tracy. My question has to deal with the legislative action amending in the zoning. For your information, how it's going to affect existing private-funded services, such as the rescue mission. Under the proposed qualifying provisions, you have under Section 2, Item D, that you're going to require the insurer of areas to have queuing take place within a footprint around the principal building and will not occur in any public street or sidewalk. How does this affect places like the Rescue Mission or St. Vincent's that are not part of the road home in terms of your zoning regulations? How is it going to affect them or any future privately funded facilities? Are they going to be also under this type of amendment? Because this is basically a law that you're trying to provide under a zoning regulation. How's that going to affect? And I spoke with Representative Dunnigan, and he stated that it probably wouldn't affect them that are already existing. So what is the future outcome of that? What are the people who are wanting to possibly provide future private services, how is it going to affect them? Thank you.
I'm sorry, any way we can get your name?
I said Tracy.
Tracy? Okay.
Well, I know our legislative body, which is the City Council, as they are moving forward on zoning changes, those zoning changes will be specific to the four resource center sites only. And if I am mistaken, I know that Council Member Kitchen is here and could step up to a microphone and correct me, but that's my understanding, and that there would be no impact on St. Vincent's or the Rescue Mission.
My name is Jeff Baer. I'm the Vice Chair of Liberty Wells Community Council. And during this process, there was the discussion of two versus more. And as you said, the point was we have to staff and fund those, again, two versus more than two. And I'm wondering at this point if the Simpson Avenue site has become so much of a distraction, and especially the cost for that site, if it wouldn't help move the whole process along of selecting a different site, removing all the contention and everything that has just... Everyone's focused on that, and they're not looking at the whole picture and the whole plan. One possible site, I don't know all the criteria, but I've wondered about the old DI on Sugar Mount. It seems almost ideal. You've got the park, you've got the pool, you've got the med center that's going to be built right next door. There's commerce around. The S line is right there. So again, just kind of wondering, is it time to maybe move on from Simpson and help move the whole process along?
What I can tell you is that when the council and I were reviewing all of the sites that were available to us to review, the four that we landed on were the four we could all agree on, regardless of how we were numbering them. And the majority of the council and I are still standing firm on the decision on the four sites that we have today.
All right. Thank you.
Let me get someone from the other side.
Hi there. My name is Krishna Sinha, and I'm a Salt Lake City Avenues area resident. And I have been involved in some way for the last 16 years with the Road Home on certain aspects of there. And I have a question. First, today's article in the newspaper says, actually, it starts with the caption of it, says, Utah homelessness up despite federal reports saying it is down. And I think metaphorically, just a comment that it's a crime to put data out, doesn't matter whether it's state or federal, without the constraints involved in. Is there, and Mayor McAdam made a statement that hopefully from in years to come, we will have more accurate data. First question is, is it a matter of years to take to have a consistency between the HUD or the Department of Federal data collection? And is there any way that the two can sit together and have a... If I read this article, I'm still not clear whether it's up or down. And if I'm not clear, he's not clear, people are not clear, we cannot have, it's a complex issue, we cannot have a solution that fits to it if we can't even decide on the statistics. And the other question before I sit down, is there any record in certain segments or sectors of the society, there is a myth or this floating that, well, during the time that it came in, that Salt Lake City has gotten national recognition, is dealing with this problem, people from other states, homeless, started moving in here. I don't know whether it's a truth or myth. Is there any figure on the homeless population here? Is it all local, or they come from outside as well? Thank you.
Yeah, well, first of all, I would say thank you for your comment. One of the challenges when I say mapping the genome of homeless services is the data. Now, all of our providers collect data, and I think one of the challenges has been they collect data and they use it for internal purposes, but we don't currently use it in real time for system evaluation. So oftentimes we do have system level data, but I think there's going to be a difference in the qualitative nature of the data when if you're using data to fill out forms for federal grants and report versus using it in real time to measure the effectiveness of the impacts we're having. So what we're seeing is the quality of our data is we're working to improve that quality. you know, the reports that you saw in the Salt Lake Tribune, now that's that shelter population is up, not necessarily that homelessness is up. And a lot of times we think of shelter as the same thing as homelessness. And there's a few factors that might indicate why shelter's up. Certainly it may be that there are more homeless people and it's on the rise. But there are some other factors, like some new shelters have opened. So if you have a new shelter facility in Ogden that's opened in the last couple of years, your sheltered population will go up because there are more beds. Those are people who may have been camping, they may have been on the streets, they may have been couch surfing with family, but now they're in shelter. So it's hard to really say exactly what's happening with the data, and we're putting a lot of focus on making sure that we have better understanding of the data within our system. Now, to your question about whether we, you know, people say, are we a magnet for homeless services? Do people come here because of our services? Our data doesn't seem to indicate that right now. You see, anecdotally, you hear stories of people who have come here because of the services. We don't think we're a regional draw. Now, it is true that people are coming from around the state to Salt Lake City, but I don't think they're choosing Salt Lake City over Denver or Salt Lake City over Las Vegas because of our services, but they are choosing Salt Lake City over Provo or Salt Lake City over Davis County because of the services.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Tara, did you want to add something to that? And you can have as much time as you want.
Thanks. I just want to say that the data that's being collected is collected in HEMIS, which is the Homeless Information System Center, and that data is really driven by where the funds are coming from. It's a mandate from HUD. So we do have a lot of agencies that do not put data into there, like the Rescue Mission, domestic violence. And so that is not being captured within that particular report that they're talking about. And I think it's important that we put that out there. But we are moving forward in looking at how we bring others in and other services so we can cross data to look at really some better solutions for stabilizing people. So I think it's important that the next set of data that will come out will be the point in time, which Kathy could talk about, but it will be showing a point in time during the end of January, and that will be statewide. And just to let you know that the education system also does a count that is not captured in the point in time because they have a different definition of homelessness. And so that was done on December 1st, and there's over 13,000 children right now that are considered homeless under the education definition. So I think it's important for us to understand that, you know, children need to have a stable place to be able to succeed in education.
If I may, just a couple comments about the point in time count. So once a year, and this year it was January 25th, we do surveys in all the shelters about the number of people who are staying overnight, so we're counting. And the other more complicated component is an unsheltered count, where we're going out with teams in a grid across Salt Lake County and trying to see how many people are sleeping outside and where, and counting them. And we don't always find everybody. So those numbers are the best we can do once a year, snapshot, point in time, that's the best we have, and we compare year to year, but it doesn't always match with the HMIS data or the other, and we are working on improving our data collection and the outcome tracking.
Next question.
For Mayor Biskupski, my name is Robert. What has the city legal advisors told you specifically about the obligation of the city to pay compensation for decreased property value to the residents in the Simpson area? And the other part of the question is, in looking at the pictures that have been published of the proposed Simpson site, it looks to me like the drug dealers have ready access. The people in the facility will walk out the front door right onto a public sidewalk where the dealers will be able to get to them just like they can now. So first question, what is the city legal advisors? What have they told you about the obligation of the city to pay compensation for decreased property value in the Simpson area? And how are you going to make sure the drug dealers can't have access to the people at that site?
To your first question, there has not been a specific directive coming from my legal counsel about decreased property values. I know a lot of people are concerned about that. And
I didn't ask you about the directive. I asked you what they had told you about the obligation, right, the legal obligation of the city to... Let me finish. What did they tell you about the legal obligation of the city to pay compensation?
And I will finish what I was saying, and that is... there has not been a specific conversation saying, here's how you will have to handle that, if that's what you're wondering. I know there is a lot of fear around decreased values, but we haven't had a specific discussion saying, here's how you need to manage that. And then the other piece of your question about drug dealers... we are very aware of how the drug dealers are operating. And one of the biggest things that we know is the drug dealers are hiding amongst a very large population of people who are leaving the shelter in the mornings. And when you have 150 people versus 1,300 people, it's a very different environment, and much easier for law enforcement to monitor and manage. I did have a very good conversation with Mayor Seguini, who runs a facility of over 300 people, or right around 300 people, where it's families with children. And she has a law enforcement officer on site who manages all of the issues that come up, including any sort of drugs that might present themselves. But they're not finding that they have some sort of epidemic going on.
Isn't the shelter in Midvale that you've just discussed contained within a secure perimeter fence with controlled access so that only actual residents can access the facility?
No.
Well, that's what Google Earth shows.
Maybe we're envisioning something, two different things, but anyway.
Can I ask you, Mayor Biskupski, what have you learned in this process about how the resource centers could or would affect property values?
You know, one of the things that I was talking about earlier is how the same kind of concerns came up with the VOA, and maybe you could talk to kind of the real life experience of that.
I definitely heard from residents that they were concerned about property values. When we did our research back then, we were finding some articles that indicated, with supportive housing anyway, that it did not decrease property values. Our experience at this point, too, with some of our neighbors is that we have heard remarks that our new building actually is probably helpful to their property value. So I think we have to maybe, you know, see what, but I think we have not seen that.
Well, we certainly haven't seen any requests for some sort of reimbursement by anyone who lives near that resource center.
Okay, next question.
My name's Janet Ellingson, and I'm a resident of Sugar House, a homeowner living about a half a mile or so from the Simpson site, and I just want to thank you for choosing that site. I think it's an excellent site. It has made me aware of a problem that I've been easily ignoring when it was stuffed downtown. And this gives me an opportunity, it gives the Sugar House community an opportunity to be part of the solution and help. My question is about the data. I'm not interested just simply in the count of how many are homeless. I'm wondering if you have access to reports, if it's something you can share, what is the cause of homelessness? Why are people homeless? I've never had a conversation with a homeless person. I can imagine why people are homeless. I've been close to that. I can imagine what it's like not to have the next paycheck. But I really don't know what is making people homeless. And do you guys know?
Yeah, thank you. And great question. It is something that when we were mapping our genome of homeless services that we looked very closely at. And the cause of homelessness is, first of all, different for every person, right? But there are some broad categories that we've looked at. And we actually, in our action plan, have acknowledged the existence of 9 categories. There are certainly more. Like I said, every person is a category in their own. But there are 9 categories that we're looking at in our plan. And then groupings within those categories. But we're looking at there are different causes for homelessness, and it's a great question because we also know that if you want to help somebody heal from whatever led them to crisis, you've got to recognize that they're individuals and that, you know, just like there are different causes of sickness, there's different causes of homelessness, and the treatment for sickness is different and the treatment for homelessness is different. So domestic violence is a large cause of homelessness. Somebody who is fleeing a violent situation at home with their children, that's a significant cause of homelessness. Unemployment or underemployment. There are many people who are homeless who have jobs. They just don't have first and last month's rent. They can't find affordable housing. So that's a category that we recognize. We recognize there are the people who have behavioral health disorders who need treatment, be it for whatever reason, the substance use disorder, behavioral health that need to get in treatment. So that's a different approach that we would take to homelessness. So we have 9 categories that we've identified in our plan. It's on my website, slco.org/mayor. And the underlying premise of the whole reform we're trying to do is to say we recognize that everybody's different. Now, we can't build a system to 1,100 different individuals. We have to approach it through some broad categories, but you know, youth, kids who age out of the foster care system oftentimes become homeless because, you know, I think of myself at 18. I couldn't provide for myself as an 18-year-old. So we're looking at that as a category and how we help those people in a different fashion. So that was really one of the premises that led the county to say we don't want a large one-size-fits-all shelter. We want smaller facilities that are focused on individual populations and their root causes of homelessness. And central to our collective impact approach is the philosophy that as we do this, we're not just going to serve meals and provide shelter every day, but what we want to do is we want to formulate a hypothesis and then act and then measure what effect our actions had and then adapt our actions and then start over again. Under the adapted new philosophy, we're going to act, we're going to measure our actions, and then we're going to draw conclusions from our actions. And that cycle of continuous improvement is one of the things we're trying to set up in the new model. So with that, you know, there's always going to be changes. There's always going to be adaptations as we look what is working best to help somebody to heal from their crisis. And that's why you've also seen the plan evolve over time. As we say, well, here's this intended action. We go out and gather data. In fact, in November, Salt Lake County went out and did a needs assessment of people who are homeless. So we do the point in time count every year where we go and count people in shelter, people on the streets, and we get a number of who's homeless. Well, we did this needs assessment that was more in-depth where we went and interviewed people to ask them what is their cause of their homelessness and, you know, how long have they been homeless? Have they been homeless before? You know, a lot of very sometimes private questions that's going to help us to have a qualitative understanding of our homeless population. So we got that data back in middle of December, and we're now looking at our plan to say, okay, so we have our plan, but now we're going to take our data, evaluate our data, adapt our plan to the new data, and then act again in that process cycle.
Is that data that you've gathered available?
It is available. Let me look at Shalene. Is it available on our website yet, or is it close? Did people hear that, or do you want me to repeat it? So on March 8th, that data is going to be available. We're going to do it in aggregate. So we asked some private questions that we're not going to disclose individually, that this person's, but in aggregate, we're going to disclose that information at our Salt Lake County Collective Impact meeting on March 8th, and it'll be on the website then. But that's the data that we're using right now to tweak and adapt our plan and inform our plan moving forward. And so I'd ask you to have patience with this as you see the plan evolve over time. It's really in response to the data that we've gathered, and we want to act deliberately in a way that we believe will have the maximum impact for the dollars we spend.
I'll add, too, that the collective impact meetings are public, and so you are welcome to attend and get that information firsthand.
Move on to another question.
So my name's Dan Davidson. I'm a person in long-term recovery. I've recovered from mental illness, substance use, and being homeless. And I and
Thank
first
you for
of
being
all,
here.
First of all, I want to thank you guys for all your hard work, because I don't think you get enough credit. You guys do a lot. And thank you for your hard work. I think the JRI has been a great opportunity for a lot of people. I think this thing that you guys were talking about with the recovery center and the support center is awesome, but I feel like there's a big gap. There's a big piece that you guys are missing. There's two pieces of it. First of all, these people are trying to get homes, and they can't because they have a criminal background, right? I know so many people that have struggled with this because there's been a system built to follow us for the rest of our lives. So my idea, and I'm just making a statement, I'm not asking for any answers. Why can't we build a system to follow the people that have put their lives back together as me as an example? I don't know if that means like get a certificate, a card you put in your wallet, something that is an endorsement from the state and the county saying, you know what, this person is good to go. And that lets a person get employment and housing. The other piece is bringing in awareness and smashing the stigmas. Because how can people recover if they're stuck in a stigma? Yeah. We're not labels. We're human beings. Thank you.
I appreciate your comments. One of the things that I have been working on for years is the Good Landlord Program. And it's a program that really labels you. And it's extremely hard to get housing, especially in areas that say you cannot be part of the Good Landlord Program if you house felons. Where do people get a start? I mean, it's so important. That is a huge, huge barrier. Other barriers for people for housing are their, you know, bad credit. And a lot of bad credit has to do with health problems, not to do with housing. And so whether or not you are evicted. And a lot of eviction people don't understand their rights, so they walk away because they say, hey, the landlord's not fixing this. I'm just going to walk away. Well, then all of a sudden they're evicted. Next thing you know, they're owed $1,800, and now they're on a list that basically they can't be housed. So we need to really look at these barriers as part of the solution and take those labels off people. And I agree. We have classes that people could take and get certification to say, I've learned about eviction, I've learned about tenant law, blah, blah, blah. And I think that if people were able to, you know, go to landlords and show that they have really made an effort, I think, you know, we could put these programs together and work. But we got to work together. Right now, the Good Landlord Program is on the Hill, and also the application fee. How many people have looked for housing and paid multiple application fees? Yeah. And you have no idea what you the criteria that you're being judged on. Well, this is huge, and that's also on being discussed on the Hill. We need to get that criteria put into that application fee.
So. Can I just make a quick comment? Thank you for your comments, and the sharing of your personal stories with other people I think is really important. There are a lot of homeless youth that are needing to know that they can move forward and move beyond things, move beyond substance use, beyond mental health, stabilize their situation, and move forward, and life can be better and different. So please keep telling your stories. Show up at the 12-step meetings, at the facilities. Help us bring people toward recovery. We need you.
Rossi.
So during a question and answer session at Sprague Library last week, Shalene G. from the county's homeless service office said the only reasonable use for the Sugar House Simpson Avenue Resource Center was for low-risk populations like women and children. Yet the 150 beds allocated for this site seem a little excessive for a model which aims to remove families from the homeless services system as quickly as possible. In fact, if I recall correctly, Kathy Brace stated earlier that she sees approximately 70 individuals show up at her other family shelter. Could you explain the reasoning behind paying $7 million, which might be used to help families or youth avoid ever having to visit a shelter or resource center, for a site which may end up being underutilized by its target population?
I think first it's important to understand that the $7 million was for multiple pieces of property, not just the one where the resource center will be.
Could you detail those pieces of property for us?
Yeah, there's multiple pieces of property right in that same neighborhood that were all owned by the same property owner. And so the city invested in the other properties owned by that property owner, and then with the intention of having opportunities there, but also the one piece that we wanted for the resource center. And I think that was about $3 million for that piece.
What are the other sites currently being used for? We have several businesses there.
Yes, there's businesses there. Right, which are welcome to stay there. The other thing is on this particular site, when you're talking about families are actually the fastest growing population amongst the homeless. And so the 150 or potentially only 100 beds could be at that particular location and would be probably necessary. We have how many? 70 children at the Road Home still today. And Midvale, which is the family resource center right now, is completely full. So we have to get kids out of that neighborhood. We just do.
Thank you.
Cheryl MacFarlane. Kathy, I worked with you at VOA, and while we were there, there was an individual who was on the do not admit list. You gave this individual another chance. This individual really thrived only when structure was provided from an outside source. So my question is it feasible to think that everyone can live independently? Is there a long-term solution, like a group home, where people will have that structure provided for them when they can't provide it for themselves?
Thank you. Good to see you. Yes, I mean, we know that there are different levels of support needed by different individuals. We do have some group home options to move people to from the shelter facilities. We also have a lot of what we call permanent supportive housing. So people who have disabling conditions, it might be a major mental health issue, it might even be a severe addiction that is not being treated, or a major medical issue, they have one of those disabling conditions, they may qualify to be in a permanent supportive housing environment, which means that they can live there long-term forever, and there are supports on-site, so case management and people who can visit with them and go see them. So we like to have a broad array of housing options available to us to move homeless individuals to, and we have to look seriously at the person's need for ongoing supportive services. And so some people can be very independent quickly and they don't need case management and extra supports. Other people, they may need someone to care about them and for them and visit with them regularly for the rest of their lives. And we're going to do whatever is the best for that individual.
I'd like to see more of that model, because the individual that I'm referring to ended up going out and living with family and then ending up homeless again.
Oh.
Do you remember that?
No, not off the top of my head, I do not. But
It was when the facility first opened, the women's and children's facility. It was very heartbreaking.
It's so hard sometimes to see people's individual paths. And what we hope is that if the first attempt didn't work, that they come back and we'll try we'll try something else that works, and we hope that they'll stay connected to us. Thank you.
Hello, good evening. My name is Emily. I'm a resident of Sugar House. So the scattered site model aims to reduce the impact of emergency services throughout the community and also the preventative services that you have discussed tonight. Did the committee look at a system of micro shelters for only maybe 8 or 10 beds in buildings that look like single family homes that blend into neighborhoods that could be scattered throughout the entire city, including more affluent neighborhoods, to create like an invisible web of support in the city and and countywide? This would prevent overcrowding and would also provide individual care for residents of the facility while engaging the entire community and not just four pockets in working class neighborhoods. If you did consider it, why was the model not adopted? And if you didn't discuss it, why not?
So I can thank you. Thank you. As I say, the plan is always evolving as we get more and better data. And one of the things we always want to do with this is make sure that before we act, we're acting on the most current, best data, and that we're then evaluating our action and adapting accordingly. So, you know, I talked about this assessment that we went out in the community and did in late November, and that's the data that we're looking at right now, and we're going to be presenting in March. But there are models like that that work incredibly well. In fact, there's a county-run facility in Sandy City called Milestone House. Now, Milestone House has a very small number of beds, and it's targeted on adolescents, kids who age out of the foster care system, the ones I referenced, who turn 18 and oftentimes find themselves homeless or in shelter, or they couch surf until friends will no longer allow them to couch surf, and then they're in shelter. And these models work well. They have to have a high level of mentorship and supervision, but we've found these models work. And so as we look at the data and we start seeing, understanding better the population in our shelter, more than just a man of a certain age or a woman of a certain age, but as we're understanding more qualitatively the data, we're evolving our recommendations accordingly, and these are things we're looking at more of, akin to this county program we have in Sandy City, that more of those might work. As you might imagine, because you know you can't just put 8 19-year-olds in a housing unit without supervision. Even the best 19-year-olds are going to be problematic under that scenario. So a model like that is expensive in the day by day. But what we look at is, you know, there's such great success stories coming out of this county program where kids who are in this program for 18 months and their exit trajectory is college and jobs, and, you know, it's incredible. So these programs are more expensive, and we have to look at what we can afford today. But we also have to recognize that having somebody be in this program for only 18 months and never again being homeless is also a longer-term cost saving. So that's some of the data and analysis we're looking to do right now, is not just look for the cheapest program day by day, but have a long-term vision of what the value is of an investment, not only of tax dollars, but the long-term value to human lives of acting responsibly.
Hi, my name is Oscar. I've been researching the issue of homelessness for a school project, and I recently learned that the city owns some vacant land near 900 South and 500 West. So my question is, why is the city spending so much taxpayer money to buy these new properties when they already own land that could be used for the resource centers? Thank you.
So there is a resource center right there that Kathy is running. And part of what the city wanted to make sure we did was spread the resource centers out in our city so that one neighborhood isn't heavily impacted like what you see today with the road home. So there is a city property involved in this process that we are using for one of the resource centers. And the other properties were purchased. So we did look at city properties and landed on one of them. And that was part of the process we went through.
I would also add, you know, as a mayor myself, we got to recognize that city-owned land or county-owned land doesn't mean it's free. It was paid for with tax dollars, and land is fungible. You can sell land. In fact, it's easy to sell land, especially in Salt Lake City, where land is scarce today. So just because it's city-owned doesn't mean it's free. I think the city, and when we've talked about this, even with the current site that's city-owned, we're not going to ask the city to just donate that land because we know they acquired it at a cost, and they could go out and sell that land and buy another land. So I know the city's focus has been finding the right facilities in the right locations, and if they have to buy it, they buy it, and if they have to sell or surplus other city land and sell it to pay for it, that's things they can do. But you know, I would caution people from just looking at it and saying, because it's city-owned, it's free. That had a cost, and it has an opportunity cost that you could sell it and take that money that you acquire from selling it to buy land somewhere else. So the focus has been getting the right locations and going from there.
Hi, I'm Lenny Fitzgerald. That's all, just a name. I've heard a lot of good things, but I'm just going to start off by saying something that what we got to remember is I call it the E theme, equip, not enable. It's a big dream. Now, if I had a ministry with $20 million, I would probably hook you up with it right now. And I really like what I hear with you, with your resource centers. We all have to come together and do this. Even LA has a dream center. We've got to encourage people individually. It's going to take a lot of volunteers. I'm willing to volunteer all of my time as a facilitator. I don't have the means of the financial, but we need to let that nonprofit money come in to help us do that before it gets bigger, because we're a fast-growing community. And the homeless are not a separate entity, right? They're part of the community. So they're no, you know, we're no better than them. That, you know, we're all the same. We want them to be active members of the community. So that means we need to give them a foot up. I go talk to them one-on-one. As I spoke to a few people here already, and I asked them, how would you like a foot up? You should see their eyes light up. Wow. You know, they start following you around thinking, okay, we're going to go somewhere and get help. So we need individual assessing to each of them, with all of them with the drug behavior. They need an individual help there. Some of them have mental capabilities that they don't know they have. They need individual assessment. It's going to take a lot of work. It's going to give a lot of other people, the doctors and the people's jobs that are wanting jobs. And there's people like myself that are volunteers that are willing to facilitate all this. It's going to take a lot of planning and a lot of work. And it's going to take large ministries that will come in, which I'm doing a lot of resource searching on to get involved. So I want to stay in touch with everything that you're doing. Like, you know, we've got the VOA, what the county mayor's doing here. We've got the Rescue Haven. We've got some assisted living homes. But they're all kind of bouncing around on their own. We're not all coming together and working as one. We're one body. So I just want to say, I hope that makes an impact on what I'm saying to you. And know that I will be willing to help facilitate a growth like this. And I hope that everybody behind me heard exactly what we need to do. And that's develop the community. It's going to take a lot more work than I think anybody realizes. It's going to take something larger.
It does. And it will take some big hearts and some open minds, for sure. The one thing I do want to add to your comment is that over the summer, we opened the Community Connection Center, which is right down by the road home. And we have referred 200 people through that facility into assistance, whether it's through mental health care or drug addiction treatment. But people are getting help through there and getting connected to the help that they need. So we are looking to budget for 3 more social workers to be a part of that program so we can help even more people as they come through those doors. So, but thank you for bringing that.
That's great. Well, let's do more, and I'll do what I can to provide that.
Thank you.
All the work that I need to.
I just have to respond, too, because I like your equip idea versus enable. And I want to share with you that we have had a lot of volunteers, people in the community, stepping forward and assisting us in our Youth Resource Center. So breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day for like the last 4 months and going forward for a few more months are being done by volunteer groups. That's amazing. That's incredible community involvement. And we need it. So it's wonderful. The other thing is that community groups are coming and spending time with having their meetings in our facility so they can see what's going on. They can become more familiar, and we become a resource for the community. So it's a two-way, relationship. And I'm proud of that, and I want to just make sure. Also, I'll mention we do tours every Thursday at our youth center, and you're all welcome to come and take a look and see what a resource center, from our perspective, looks like, and it might answer some of your questions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Remember, EQIP. So that pretty soon they're not going to be just getting those meals and then back on wherever they're. No, pretty soon they'll be.
Right.
Giving the meals.
Right.
They'll be the surgeons.
Teaching people to fish.
Yep. Paying it
We've
forward.
We've got to keep them up, not just feed them and send them back out.
That's right.
We've got to keep them in.
There you go.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hello, my name is Ryan Parker. I currently work over at the downtown shelter at the Road Home. And I do want to quickly say that I am here representing myself. I do not reflect our executive directors, our board of trustees, our funders. I'm simply here as a direct staff member who has worked with every man, woman, and child down on Rio Grande. So first, I've heard a lot of great things, and actually a few of my questions were answered. So just make a quick, brief statement, and then anyone on the panel can answer just a few quick questions. So in the last year, I've had the very distinguished privilege and also burden of basically working in a place that is completely undermanned and outgunned in every situation. I've got to literally stand and give beds to hundreds of people that continue to come. There's never downtime. I don't have time to sit around. They continue to come. I've been able to see our housing team struggle with those good landlord initiatives. When you go through all the weight to try to help someone, and then because of some record back in 99, what else can we do for you? I've got to see case managers completely overwhelmed, but yet they still will go out their way to reach out to someone. I've had the privilege of really seeing all this, and every day there's always something fun on Rio Grande. Anyone's familiar with that area. But we still continue to go to work every day. So what I've noticed, and really just what I've taken from all this, is that the problem, lies so far, removed from downtown, from Rio Grande and any shelter providers. Unfortunately, some people are born there, but, people keep coming to us from failed systems in the state. When Valley Mental Health, struggles for funding, it is that these clients that are, down there being preyed upon. It is our overpacked jails that have nonviolent offenders, why our police officers can't take, the actual, predators to jail. I get to see veterans struggle with veterans affairs, and they stand in line right next to the undocumented immigrant. I get to see families and single mothers, women dealing with domestic violence, and I get to see it all under one roof. So one thing that I am in favor for is these new shelters, because we need help. We need help. So really, I do want to leave out some quick numbers that will lead up into a question. Last night, and this is point in time for anyone, we had 155 family members in our family shelter, which included 92 children. That is pretty terrifying. In Midvale, we had 261 family members, which was right after 26 hotel family members in hotels. So thank you for the city for helping with the hotels. Then we did 185 women. And then obviously the elephant in the room, 638 men. So leading up to my questions, because I will be there tomorrow and the day after that. And the day after that. With all the funds going into resource centers. Great, do what you need to do. What is going to go into housing? What is going to go into deeply affordable housing? And who sets the criteria for affordable housing? I think right there by Grand America, they got a big sign that says affordable housing. If you think $800 for a studio apartment is affordable, my hats are off to you, because I don't know anyone who does. So what will be going through the efforts for housing? Because remember, resource center or shelter needs to go somewhere. And then finally, I have a lot of scared people down there. We know what the plan is after all four shelters are open. So just let me, anyone can answer this. After the affordable housing and all this goes through and you have 600 beds and then we finally close the doors on my shelter, when you put together the total I gave you, that was about 978. Not people, including people who might just come in or stay outside. So about 378 to 400 people. Where will I tell them to go once you close my shelter?
I would like to say that we do have a bill on the Hill right now, HB 36, and it's Becky Edwards' bill, that would provide $10 million for affordable housing. $1 million of it is going to be set aside for an insurance program for landlords. And I'm encouraged. I don't believe we're going to use the funds, but I think it is a nice way to get more landlords to participate housing lower-income people, because it will give them the guarantee that if apartment is damaged beyond the deposit, that they'll get their apartment fixed. And so I believe that's going to be a really positive thing in terms of attracting more landlords. I also would love to challenge both the mayors to come and ask landlords to put, he looks at me, did you get whiplash right then?
What are you challenging me? You want an arm muscle?
Yeah. To have landlords put one apartment in a pool that we could really micromanage to make sure that we are having positive outcomes so more landlords will come to the table. Because right now, we're not going to be able to build ourselves out until we have a much larger commitment to housing. But it's a start, and I feel hope, because I've been working on this for a long time, and we've only received $2.2 million each year for the past, I want to say, 20-plus years. And so this is really encouraging. This is on top of the 2.2. So I feel hope that we'll be building more housing.
I want to add, thank you. First of all, you're on the front lines, and I appreciate that and appreciate the service you're providing. And I know that you know by name the people that we know by number, and that is a different perspective, and we're grateful for the work that you're doing. You know, I often say that this feels like we've got three fires burning in one bucket of water, and how are we going to address the challenges in front of us? And what I'm trying to do when we talk about data-driven decision-making and our collective impact process is to say we're going to look at these three fires and recognize one of the fires that's burning is sitting next to a gas can, and one of them may be burning in the middle of gravel, right? We want to put both of them out, but if I have one bucket of water, I'm going to put out the one next to the gas can. So that was the premise of saying we're not just going to develop a plan, lock and load, that's the plan we're doing. We are learning and evaluating and adapting every step along the way. So that's this cycle of continuous improvement. But the foundation for that cycle of continuous improvement was the outcomes that we adopted a year and a half ago, that we came together, over 30 providers of homeless services, Salt Lake County, Salt Lake City, the state of Utah, and said, these are the outcomes. This is the goals that we want to accomplish. And then we're going to look at every action through the lens of these goals. And I'm going to tell you about two outcomes that we've adopted that I look at every time we're evaluating our plans. I look at all of them, but we say, are we going to advance ourselves towards achieving these goals? And the first one is that people in crisis have access to necessary support services. So, you know, while we want people to not need shelter, we want them to have access when they need it. The goal is that they don't need it, not that it's not there for them. So that every person in need has access to necessary support services. The second one is that we're going to divert people from shelter wherever possible. So shelter is necessary. Shelter is not the best place for somebody to heal. It's a temporary stop as we can get them out as soon as, you know this, we want to get them out as soon as possible into housing, into treatment, into whatever is going to help them to heal. Shelter is that emergency room where you stop the bleeding and then you get them to where they're going to be able to heal. So that we divert people from shelter wherever possible. So as we're looking at it, as we gather this data and we're crunching the data to match it up with our plans and recommendations thus far and then adapt our plans before the cycle begins again. One of the things that we're constantly asking ourselves is, can this population be better served than shelter? Can we divert them from shelter wherever possible? Is there a program like the Milestone House for adolescent youth where we can get them instead of shelter? Is there housing? You know, housing, can we get people into housing instead of shelter? And we have an immense need for affordable housing, and I think everybody's looking, the state and the county and the city, at how to develop more affordable housing options that are, you say, you know what, there are different definitions of affordable. What we're looking at is deeply affordable, which we define as 15% of AMI, adjusted median income, or area median income. I would choose AMI. So some of those options that where we want to get people out of shelter. We want to not need shelter. We want it to be there. We want shelter available if they need it. We want them to not need it. We want to divert them from shelter as whenever possible. So those are goals that we're looking at, and it's through those lens that we are evaluating every plan, every recommendation, every scenario that's put forward. We look at it through that lens. So I don't know that I have the answer for you other than we have a commitment to honor the very points that you've raised.
Can I make a couple comments? Thank you, too. I used to work at the Road Home, actually. It was so long ago, it was called Traveler's Aid Society, okay? So, but I want to thank you for your comments, and I want to assure you and other people in the room that it's been a good process to have the providers with the government, with the business, with the advocates, with people who experience homelessness, to have this conversation together, and you better believe that affordable housing is always pushed by the providers. If we don't have places to move people to that they can afford, we're stuck. They're stuck. So this has been part of the conversation the whole time, and you sounds familiar to me, and thank you. And I also want to mention that we are looking at trying to open other places. There's a conversation around whether we'll be able to reopen the detox center that we used to have in Murray for homeless women and homeless women with children. I mean, we're also looking at other opportunities to move some people from the Rio Grande area to a place that better meets their needs. And so those efforts are also being discussed, and we're trying to raise money for it.
Mayor Buskupski, if we can take your comment and then one more question. We're just about out of time here, but I want to get one more question from the public before we end.
Okay, so Salt Lake City just released our housing strategy. It's a 5-year plan. It's called Grow SLC. It's online. It's being reviewed by the council right now. But parts of Grow SLC in there are some very progressive ideas to remove barriers to get people into housing, and I'm very hopeful that the council will be supportive of our vision on this. The other piece to this is we launched our Blue Ribbon Commission. That is a group that is made up of financial investors as well as developers on how do we truly put affordable housing into the market and keep it there. And this is a very thoughtful group that is looking at this from many creative spaces. And our own team at hand, we just launched our land trust plan. And our land trust plan, we buy land, we put housing on it, and it forever is low-income housing. And so we can put families in there, they can grow equity in this house and move out with the equity
and move into another facility, and we still have our low-income housing. So the land trust idea, I think, is something that will continue to grow, and we will continue to build housing opportunities that we will control forever, and that will be incredibly helpful in this process.
This is going to be our final question.
Thank you. My name is Bernie Hart, and I have had a series of little observations. The Travelers Aid Society, I did a little research on the history of service providers in Salt Lake a few months ago, and the average time probably that they've been providing services to the homeless community, and they're to be complimented for it, but to be put in a proper context, the problem either overwhelmed the services they provided or the services they provided didn't adequately deal with the problem. And it could be either one of the two or a combination of the two, because they've been doing it at an average of close to 40 years. And that includes the 12-step house and VOA and the Traveler's Aid and all the organizations that have been here forever. And we still have the same problem. And that's what concerns me. Is the only thing I see new about this is the data-driven spiral. But unless you have outside community oversight from people that are actually engaged and are at the receiving end and have to deal with any failures within the system, we aren't going to trust that system that has been at work for 40 years to provide services to people we care about, because I deal with the homeless all the time, and I see the city's efforts in dealing with the campers and their failures to deal with this problem. They're great at cleaning it up and moving the homeless off where they are, and the campers and the people that are addicts and mentally ill, they'll shift them in a heartbeat with a complaint from somebody, but they haven't really learned how to deal with the problem in a way that doesn't make it occur. So you use the audits, and that's my question is, will you allow meaningful community insight or oversight of this process, because we no longer trust the service providers and the county and the state to create their own models of success? We want to know, and we want to have some input. We want to have some say as to what's working or not. And the models that keep being brought up on the Odyssey House and the YMCA, the things that Mr. Litvak and the city like, and I wish David was here. I love the guy. I give him a hard time, but he's a great guy. The models they keep bringing up. When I go by, and I live right on 8th South, when I go by these facilities, I never see anybody on the street. I never see the clients walking around. I never see people walking from the public in and out of these buildings. It's like there's an invisible wall there that keeps people away. Is that how the new models are going to be, or do the people on Simpson Street really have to worry about? Because there's this, you know, a large number of moms, even if it's a family thing, who are addicts. And if they're not in the unit all the time, and if they refuse treatment, which is part of one of the models that the county is relying on for some of their data collection, is putting users into facilities whether they agree to treatment or not, what stops them from going out into the community to look for drugs? And if it's not a closed thing. So, number of questions, but I love the idea. I love the way you've run this tonight, because we've had a chance to follow up and have meaningful questions. So,
thank you. There were a lot of questions built into that, and I think the one thing that I want to say
there's still a lot of unanswered questions, too.
There's a lot of work to be done. And I just want to mention that we, over the years, thousands of people have been moved out into the community housing successfully through a lot of efforts by nonprofit organizations.
I want to add that for the first time since I've lived in Utah, this is the first time I've ever seen any leadership around homelessness in terms of the city and the county. I'm getting there. It's the leadership that's going to bring solutions. The providers have been on their own forever. They have been the people that have been raising their hands and taking care of the problem with inadequate funding.
and inadequate support from our city and our county leaders. And I want to commend both mayors here for really taking this extremely difficult, complex job on. And there has been a lot of great discussions.
My main question, we only have a lot of time. We hear this all the time. There's people selling us what you want to say.
Well, I was speaking to your first comment.
Were the Odyssey House and the site's going to be run the same way, where we don't see traffic on the street? And is there going to, the county and the spiral and overseeing the spiral, allow us going to have community insight and input meaningfully? So those are the two questions I want answered.
Let me take a stab at it.
Yeah.
Let me take a stab at it. First of all, I want to say you've heard about our county collective impact process. I want to say that collective impact, a lot of people think that's just a catchy word for everybody working together. That's not what collective impact is. I would encourage you to... So collective impact is academic approach to how you align systems, complex systems where you've got dozens of actors trying to impact the system for good, and how do you align that and harness it in a collective way to have an impact. So Google collective impact and Stanford Innovation Review. You're going to see a few articles, pretty quick, a dense read, but five pages or so to learn about what collective impact is. The second is how is the community going to be able to evaluate this? So one of the things we want to do, I talk about that data-driven cycle where we measure, we act, measure, evaluate, and start over. One of the things we're talking about doing is asking the community to help us to develop a dashboard for each specific site. The dashboard meaning just like in your car, you've got the instruments that tell you how fast you're going, how much gas you have, what direction you're heading, and we want to do that for our shelters. What metrics do we want to see around our shelters? How do we measure that? And let's report it to you. Let's put it up on the website. You can look at it. We can have regular meetings to come back and help us know whether these shelters are working as we'd like to see them work, and we can work with you to improve it. Now, you asked what's different, and I think the data-driven approach is different than what we've done in the past. There's also a big difference this time around. Now, our providers have learned, their providers have improved, and we are seeing, we see people who come up here and say they're formerly homeless. It's a great signal that something's working, and we need to find out what worked with those individuals and replicate it. But there's one big difference that's happened, I'd say, in the last 10 years, is that mental illness is no longer something we don't talk about, that we don't understand. We understand today that behavioral health, that substance use disorder, is in almost all cases linked to mental health, not in all cases, but in many cases linked to mental health. And that is something that we acknowledge. We recognize it is okay to recognize that there are individuals with mental health who need various treatment at various levels. It's accepted. Now, what's happened is also, as being accepted, it's also starting to get covered by insurance and Medicaid. So the big difference, the big game changer, if you want to see things measurably improve. Now, we wouldn't have a homelessness meeting wouldn't be, we have a joke, that our meetings wouldn't be complete without me giving a shout out for Medicaid expansion. So I think this is my window. If we want to measurably improve homeless services in the Salt Lake Valley, we must provide access to health care, including behavioral health care, to people who are in crisis on our streets.
Okay. We're actually over time, so thank you all so much for coming. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much to our panelists.
Thank you. Thank you.
And if you want to listen to this again, or if someone else asks about it, it's going to be on our website, KUER.org. Thanks again.